77 WABC. And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Welcome to Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik. Thank you for joining me this evening. You know, I was coming here to the studio. Mr. Kraglander, you'd be interested in hearing this because you're a sports fan. And some tall guy stopped me in the street and said, you want to buy some playoff tickets? And I said, Aaron Judge, you should not be selling playoff tickets. It's inappropriate. As one from Boston, of course, I'm happy. But let me just say this. I know there's been a lot of criticism directed at the Yankees. They played a good series. They won 100 games during the year. The last play of the last game was decided in a mini second. It could have gone either way. And, you know, when you win 100 games, you should be proud of yourself. And, you know, although I'm happy with the results, I think that the other team deserves respect. And I go back to the days of Mickey Mantle. When he would hit a home run and circle the bases, he wouldn't pump his fists. He wouldn't do any of those moves because he realized that on the mound was a pitcher who was hurting at the moment. So it's great to win. It's not a great feeling to lose. But hopefully we walk away and say, you know, good series. Both teams deserve commendation. One of the nice things about being a rabbi is that I get to meet some very special people. And one of them that I'm going to be speaking with soon is Dr. Anthony C. Ferreri. Wait till you hear about a gag rule that was in place that most people don't know about. And I think you'll be very, very relieved when you hear what's transpired. We'll be back after these messages.
Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC. 77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
Let us go to the conference line and speak with a very good friend and someone who has served the public selflessly for many years. And I'm talking about Dr. Anthony C. Ferreri, who serves now as Regional Director, Region 2 of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And that encompasses New York, New Jersey, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. How are you, Dr. Ferreri?
I'm doing well, Rabbi. And how are you?
Thank you so much. I was talking to some people about a gag rule, and they looked at me and said, no, you're kidding. I said, no, I just learned of this myself. So talk about what it is and what's being done.
You know, I have to confess that even with 40 years of service in the healthcare industry, I wasn't aware of gag rules affecting the price of prescriptions in this country. So as it turns out, there are gag rules that restrict pharmacies from sharing information with patients who come to their drugstores with prescriptions for themselves. The gag rule is issued by the sometimes the health insurance company, sometimes by the drug company, and it restricts the pharmacist from letting the patient know that there are less expensive alternatives to purchasing the medication through their insurance plan. Sometimes it's even cheaper to just pay out of pocket for the medication. But the pharmacist has been restricted and has not been allowed by most of these agreements from sharing that information with the patient.
I would imagine people would be screaming if this were known, you know, more to the public. You go to a drugstore and you have to, you know, obviously pay for the medication, and you simply say, is there anything that would do the same but cost less? And the pharmacist can't tell you.
That's absolutely correct.
Wow. Shocking.
Until now, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah. What? So what's happened?
All right. So on October 10th, this past Wednesday, the president signed two legislations into law. One is referred to as the Know the Lowest Price Act. Pretty simple, right?
Right.
And that prohibits a prescription drug plan under Medicare or Medicare Advantage from restricting a pharmacy from informing an enrollee of any difference in price, whether that be copay or out-of-pocket. So that restriction on the pharmacist is now being lifted under this legislation. The other legislation that was signed on Wednesday was the Patient Right to Know Drug Prices Act. Again, says it all. And that ensures that health insurance issuers and group health plans do not prohibit or punish pharmacy providers for providing certain information to enrollees. So now we have eliminated the restriction on pharmacists who have been told in the past if they want to participate in a particular network or carry a particular drug, that they weren't allowed to share certain information with the patients who came to their pharmacies to purchase that medication.
Dr. Ferreri, why weren't people making noise about this before? This has gone on for some time, this gag rule.
Yes, it has been, and it's not widely known. And that's probably why people have not been complaining about it. So this falls under the four priorities that Secretary Alex Azar came to Washington with when he was named as the Secretary for Health and Human Services. His four priorities are dealing, of course, with the most important one, and that is the opioid crisis facing this nation. His second priority, and not exactly in this order, but second priority is to reduce the cost of prescription drugs, which is what we're seeing here with this legislation. The third is to reduce the cost of health insurance. And the fourth is to encourage more a transformation in healthcare in the United States and move more in a direction of value-based healthcare. Transformation of healthcare from illness and procedure to quality, value, and outcome.
All right. Dr. Anthony C. Ferreri, federal government is lucky to have you. And thank you so much for alerting us about this latest development. I'm sure many people will be relieved to know that they can now obtain vital information about purchasing something at a much lower cost.
And I thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to once again be a guest on your program. You provide a wonderful service, Rabbi, and my regards to Deacon as well.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. This portion of Religion Online is brought to you by Calvary Hospital. We go to the conference line and speak with Pastor William Devlin, who is in Turkey with the release now of Pastor Andrew Brunson. And Bill Devlin, whom I've been privileged to know for many years, is the pastor of the Infinity Bible Church in the Bronx. He's the president of Redeem. He's the co-chair of Right to Worship NYC. And we anointed him global ambassador of the New York Board of Rabbis. So live from Turkey, Pastor William Devlin. Bill, how are you?
Thank you, Rabbi Joe Potasnik. It's a pleasure to serve with you and the New York Board of Rabbis, and as you've entitled me, the global ambassador for the New York Board of Rabbis. And that's exactly what I'm doing here in Izmir, Turkey, Turkey's third largest city. And we just had here on October the 12th, late in the afternoon, some exciting news. Pastor Brunson, this American pastor who has labored in Turkey for 23 years and then imprisoned for 2 years and a week, just got released by the Turkish court today at around 3 o'clock Turkish time. So we're excited that he is now going to go home. And we were sitting on pins and needles on the end of our chair. This is the fourth time I've been here in Izmir advocating for Pastor Brunson. I originally met, thanks to you, with some Turkish diplomats in New York. That was December of 2017 when we had all just learned about his year-long imprisonment. And that's when I said to the diplomats, if you release Pastor Brunson, I'm willing to serve out the remainder of his prison sentence. And you were there in the room at the time, right across the street from the UN. They rejected that. And then at his first hearing in April of 2018, I said, I'm going to be an advocate for this brother pastor of mine. So thank you, Rabbi Joe Potasnik, New York Board of Rabbis, for just getting me in that initial meeting. That put fuel in my engine. That got me to Turkey four times. And we advocated for him around the world. And we had literally thousands of people praying from around the world for his release. And when they announced his release today, because the entire trial has been in Turkish, we couldn't even believe it. And it wasn't until we exited the courtroom, we're out in the parking lot of the prison, that we said to our Turkish translators, we said, what happened? And they said, he's free. Pastor Brunson's free. So we're elated. We're excited, particularly for him. And I'm elated because if he had gone to prison and they did the switch, Pastor Devlin would have been in prison. So I'm glad I didn't have to go to prison today, Rabbi Potasnik.
Yeah, you know, you've always been one who is ready to sacrificed yourself for the safety of others. You've redeemed many hostages over the years. Usually they're Christian hostages being held against their will simply because they're Christians. What were the charges against Pastor Brunson?
They were long and voluminous, and they had said that he was part of the Kurdish resistance, the YPK, and the PKK and the YPG, which are branded terrorist organizations by the Turkish government. They said that he was involved with this Turkish imam, Fethullah Gulen. So today, the prosecutor, when he reread the indictment, which took him over an hour late this afternoon, they said, well, you were not a part of the terrorist organization, but you supported them. But it was all bogus, bootleg, trumped up charges. They had, you know, my brother-in-law's cousin twice removed. His wife saw some Kurdish literature in the church. No one could substantiate any firsthand evidentiary evidence. And so all these false witnesses came in, and the poor guy, so in the courtroom today, he was facing maybe up to 35 years in prison. I'm not going to go through all the charges, but he was facing the rest of his life, really, in prison. He's 51 years old, 35 years. You know, he would have been in his 80s. So when the prosecutor got done reading the indictment today, he recommended to the three-judge panel who had been hearing the case since April, get Pastor Brunson back in prison. So then the president judge recessed the court for 15 minutes. I went up and tried to speak to Pastor Brunson, and I said, Pastor, who was then at that time crying. And I said, Pastor Brunson, he said, I know you, Pastor Devlin. I said, well, if you go to prison, tell him that you have a replacement. So, and at that time, his wife came up to him and they hugged for about 5 minutes. So the courtroom, Rabbi Joe Potasnik, was filled with this emotion. It was just unbelievable. And then the judge came back and said, you're guilty, Pastor Brunson. We sentence you to 3.1 years, but you've already been in prison 2 years and a week. Time served, travel ban lifted, you're free to go. So because of the Turkish English, there was some lag time in the translation. Like I said, it wasn't until we got out in the prison parking lot that the translators came out. We're all there, the diplomats, the U.S. media, myself, some Turkish pastors. We said, well, what's the verdict? And the translator said, he's free to go. Yeah.
Let me ask you, the American government, the president had spoken about this pastor some time ago. Were there backdoor negotiations here to facilitate this release?
Well, there were. NBC News was reporting before the trial of today that there had been some senior White House administration officials that were talking with Turkish diplomats in Washington, D.C., but no one could substantiate that. Mm-hmm. When I arrived at the trial today in Izmir on Friday, October, October 12th, the press, the media was asking me if I had any firsthand information. I said, no, it's all hearsay as I know. So the word that I've been giving, Rabbi Joe, is so people are asking, well, what was the give up that the American government? I said, there was no give up. And they said, well, what were the secret negotiations? I said, there were none. And if you cannot explain the release of Pastor Brunson, then you know that God's people were praying and that God was in the midst of it. So there's no human or earthly reason for his release. All I can say was the prayers of good people from around the world that I've been recruiting over these past 2 years for his release. And Rabbi Joe, we had thousands of people praying on every continent, North America, Canada, South Central America, Cubans. We had Europeans, Scandinavians, we had Asians, we had Africans. And you know I travel the world, and everywhere I go, I was saying, pray for Pastor Brunson along with other imprisoned people of faith, not just Christians, but now that I'm a part of the International Religious Freedom Roundtable at the State Department as a volunteer, we get all kinds of requests for release this person and that person. So it was really the prayers of good people that led to Pastor Brunson.
Yeah, well, I'm sure also that the imprisonment of Pastor Brunson was a worldwide issue. We had spoken about it. People all around the world had addressed the issue and demanded his release. So I have to believe there was some pressure put on the Turkish government. I think there must have been some discussions between our government and Turkey. The president certainly made it known this was a primary issue for him as well. So everyone together probably made a difference. We're going to learn soon as to what really happened. I just think you're a remarkable human being. You travel the world. You put yourself in the most dangerous positions to help other people. What is that DNA? You know, you have a family, children, grandchildren, wife, and you know, certainly a loving human being. What is it that inspires you to do that?
Well, it was many years ago as a young man, and I had been an avid supporter of Israel and the Jewish people, and it was probably back in the early 1980s where I read a story about the silence of Christians during the Shoah, during the Holocaust. And, you know, I always say that that's the black eye of the Christian church during the time of the Holocaust, the Shoah. And I just kept reading about the silence of evangelicals, about mainline denominations, that they would not stand up for the Jews. And then I read a statement, "If not us, then who? And if not now, then when?" So that began to burn Rabbi Joe, to burn a hole in my heart. And then finally, it was during the time that the Yazidis and the Christians were getting run out of Iraq and other Middle Eastern countries that I made a decision to resign from a very comfortable position at a church in Manhattan. I gave up a salary. I gave up benefits. I went to my church council and I said, "I'm formally resigning because God has burned this hole in my heart to go to imprison people of faith, whether they're Jewish, Christian, Yazidi, etc." And then I created this little organization called Redeem, began to raise money. I don't take any government money, and God, give credit to him, he has just grown this passion in my heart. I started with one investor. It's now grown to over 300. I have many faith-based organizations that invest in the work I do. And part of the niche of what I do, Rabbi Joe, and you know this, is wherever imprisoned people of faith are around the world, I'm going to get on a plane and I'm going to go. I've done that for three people of faith in Sudan. I did it for Pastor Saeed Abedini, went to Iran, and now Pastor Brunson. So I know that people of faith that listen to your program, this is what we need to do. If our faith is important to us, whether we're Christian, Jewish, or otherwise, then our faith needs to be active. And instead of just sitting in a Shabbat or sitting in a church service or wherever they worship, we as people of faith, men and women, teenagers, millennials, we need to join together, because if not us, then who? And if not now, then when? And, you know, that was the same passion that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had. And I want to carry that passion on now until the day I die. So I resigned from a very comfortable place in my life where I had been for a number of years. And I said, I'm going to the hard and dangerous places of the world where nobody else is going. And if I perish, I perish, much like what Esther said to Mordecai in the book of Esther in the Hebrew scriptures.
You know, we often say you preach a sermon not just with your mouth, but with your hands and your feet. And you have really traveled the world with your hands and feet to help others who are suffering. I remember sitting with you, and you know that moment. We were sitting together. It was at the New York Board of Rabbis conference room. And there was a family there from Israel. I think they had emigrated from Ethiopia. And their son had crossed into Gaza and was being held hostage. They hadn't heard from him. They hadn't found out anything. And you said, I'm going to Gaza. I'm going to see what I can do. I'm going to meet with the officials, and I'm going to try to get him released. And I know you're still working on that issue there. There isn't a place in the world that you haven't been where needed. I mean, you're just one of these remarkable human beings.
But let me add, Rabbi Joe, and if people think we sound like we're patting one another on the back, well, no, we're just thanking God for the friendship that has developed between you and myself. And frankly, you, Rabbi, and the New York Board of Rabbis have opened up many doors to me. It was 4 years ago when I was on this very program that someone heard me when we were talking about Gaza, and you asked me, where do you want to go next? And I said, I want to go help the Yazidis. A producer from ABC News was listening to your Sunday morning radio program, called me on the phone, gave me the number of the leader of the Yazidis in America. I called him up, and 2 months later, we're in the middle of Iraq and Kurdistan helping the Yazidi people. Yeah. So you've been a great contributor just to open up huge doors to me. And I always go back to that great verse in the Hebrew Scriptures that if you bless the Jews, if you bless Israel, you yourself will be blessed.
Well,
I hope so. You and the New York
Board of Rabbis. We certainly preached it over the years. I hope so. But let me just say, I've been privileged to know you. And so people listening saying, look, I'm not traveling to Gaza and I'm not traveling to all these other places, but I want to do something to help Pastor Devlin. I want to do something to help those who seek to be released from these dangerous places, from being in prison.
Yeah.
What can they do?
Yeah, well, they can follow me on Facebook, William P.B. Devlin. That's William P.B. Devlin. Or they can go, we have two websites if people want to invest, and all the money that they send in goes directly to projects. I do not take a salary from the organization, so they can go to livereckless.info. That's livereckless.info. Or they can go directly to Widows and Orphans. That's Widows, then the word A-N-D, orphans.info. Livereckless.info, Widows and Orphans.info. And then they can find out, how they can invest in our work. If they want to come with me, I'm always recruiting people to come with me. If they want to give a couple of dollars, $1 or $2, they can do that through livereckless.info and widows and orphans.info.
I have to
so
tell you,
thank
Bill,
you so much, Rabbi.
Yeah, Bill, before I let you go, I have to tell you that so many times when I speak of you, people look at me and say, come on, you're exaggerating. You're telling me one of these stories that's not true. I say, you haven't met Bill Devlin. I think when all of us met Bill Devlin, we all said, wait a minute, can there be someone like this in the world? I mean, this is a saintly soul who just is not afraid of danger. It's not part of, not an impediment for him. And then we tracked you, we got to know you better, said, well, yeah, he's real. And you have now a big following. And there you are marching in the Israel Day parade, waving to everybody. And, you're one who not just marches in a parade, but you march into these places and you help people. What does your wife say? I'm just curious. What does your wife say? She got married to you, looking for a very, peaceful life. And I guess it's peaceful because you're not home that much. But what did she say about all this?
Yeah, people say, well, Pastor Devlin, you have a great marriage because you're never there. No.
Yeah.
After 40 years, Nancy, my bride, I don't call her my wife. I call her my bride. We are very much in love 40 years later. You know, she's a sixth grade teacher at an inner city school. And, so we get along great. God has blessed us with five children, Naomi, Sarah, Luke, Zachariah, and Lydia. We've got three Hebrew names in there. And we're expecting grandchild number 7.
Wow.
So, I love that Jewish phrase. I'll probably mispronounce it, but it's tikkun olam.
Right. Very good. You say it better than a lot of people I know who are Jewish. So it's great. That's great.
And so Rabbi, and I say this, you already know this, but I say this to your great listeners, if we're not going out and lighting a candle in the darkness, then who is?
Yeah.
If not us, then who? And if not now, then when? Every day, We hear about a crisis here or a crisis there. And that's really what happened to me is during the Obama administration, everybody was saying to the president at that time, boots on the ground, boots on the ground, you know, send in the military. And I said, well, I'm in God's army. I'm going to put on my boots and I'm going to go. So I'm happy to do it. And I'm just happy for the support of you, Rabbi Joe, and the New York Board of Rabbis, as you lovingly say, I am your global ambassador.
That's an honorary title. No salary attached. Thank you for accepting those terms. Yeah. You know, someone said years ago to me, when you begin your life as a rabbi, you feel badly if you have one enemy in the congregation. When you conclude, you hope you still have one friend. Let me say to you, if you have a friend like Bill Devlin, you could not do better. So we're very, very blessed. And I thank you, and stay safe. It's always a stay safe, and keep doing those mitzvahs. Keep doing those good deeds. We love you.
I will. All right. Thank you. God bless. Right. And encourage people to livereckless.info or widowsandorphans.info. And thank you so much for having me on today.
All right.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of religion on the line on 77 WABC.
Welcome back to Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, one of the great servants of New York, and probably, I would say, the country, has been former police commissioner Ray Kelly, who's now the CEO of the Guardian Group. And he's always involved in some important project. This is a person who doesn't believe in stepping back, but really stepping up and doing that which needs to be done. So it's a great honor to go to the conference line and speak with former police commissioner, now CEO of the Guardian Group, Ray Kelly. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Rabbi, it's always great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
This is the first time we've been one another. We're not at St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Yes, right. Exactly. So I see you more than any place.
Yeah. So let's talk about the new work that you're doing. You mentioned to me that you're involved with the issue of anti-Semitism. And, Commissioner, I have to say, over the years, this is one issue that doesn't go away. I mean, we're always, since I've been a young boy, I've always heard about anti-Semitism. It's like a sickness for which we have found no real cure.
You're absolutely right. It's been around for thousands of years. And it's not going away, believe me. It's not going away certainly anytime soon. I'm involved in it because of Ronald Lauder. Ron Lauder is the president of the World Jewish Congress. He's a famous name in New York and certainly a famous name in Jewish philanthropy and philanthropy in general. As I say, he's chairman of the World Jewish Congress, which has a footprint in at least 50 countries. And his goal is to make the Jewish diaspora safer. And he enlisted my help to take a look at the status of anti-Semitism, take a snapshot of it in certain countries in Europe and Argentina. I assembled a team that includes David Cohn, my former director of intelligence in the NYPD, and Mitch Silver, who was the director of intelligence analysis, and we have embarked on that mission. We visited many countries this past year. We've been in France and Germany, Austria, Hungary, Belgium, England. And we are talking to many people. Many people, obviously, Jewish leaders, president, former government officials, prime ministers, members of the Muslim community, the police. We even wore kippahs, yarmulkes, on the streets in Paris just to judge the reaction. So what we found is no surprise. Anti-Semitism is widespread, and it exists in varying degrees in every country that we visit. It's cyclical. It comes and goes, but you can see it now at what I think is a high point. And to a certain extent, it has been driven by the move to the political right in certain countries in Europe. And that sort of given a cover for, you might say, neo-Nazism to surface in certain of these countries. Now, much of this movement really came about as a result of increased immigration, but it sort of gives a cover for anti-Semitism to rear its ugly head. And it's a problem. It is yes, there are acts of violence against members of the Jewish community, but it really is an issue of attacking a way of life. It's harassment of people in Jewish communities, harassment of people certainly who wear, obviously Jewish garb, that sort of thing. And it's made, I think, for high anxiety in the Jewish world, in Western Europe, and Eastern Europe, too.
So you know that members of the Jewish community, for example, in areas of France, were told, don't wear a yarmulke, don't wear a kippah, wear a baseball hat if you want.
That's right.
But nothing that instantly identifies you as a Jew. Now, you said you wore a kippah and the others with you. What happened?
It was unclear. We thought there was some reaction, but not speaking French very well was a little difficult to determine, but we continue to do that as we visit the European countries to sort of take the temperature. It's a shortcut way of seeing what people's reaction is, and as you said, what we call camouflage aliyah. You know, aliyah is the expression where Jewish people will leave where they are
right,
and go to Israel, sort of go home to Israel. And some rabbis, certainly, and leaders in France have put out the word that, hey, you shouldn't wear a kippah. You shouldn't, manifest your Jewishness. And, that's simply something that shouldn't be tolerated and can't be tolerated. But it's a dicey situation. People are concerned. And what we see is sort of camouflage aliyah, what you just referred to, where baseball caps are worn. People are hiding their Jewishness, and aliyah is a fact of life.
Mm-hmm.
People getting up and moving their whole families to Israel, but it's changing the very nature of the countries that they're coming from.
You know, here we are. Was it 80 years after the Holocaust, and the beginning of the Holocaust, and we're talking about anti-Semitism, neo-Nazism, people having to hide their identity. I mean, who would have thought that after all we've been through, that we see, signs of it again? And, in France, here, the home of enlightenment, you see it in England. I mean, we've seen a host of places where Jews are endangered simply by walking on the street and being identified as Jews.
Yeah. And obviously there are Holocaust deniers that seem to continue to surface. They just refuse to accept history, the history that is accepted by the entire world. There are people who just refuse to accept that. And France is probably, as I said, we've been in other countries, France is probably where the problem is most acute, because France has the most Jews in Europe, and their population is, I believe, it's decreasing and probably going to continue to decrease. There's less than 1% of the French population that are Jewish, and over 40% of the racist claims or crimes that happen are directed at the Jewish community. So it's a ongoing problem, and what we hope to do is to be able to make some recommendations to raise the safety level, raise the comfort level of the Jewish community in these countries, and certainly France in particular, and we've engaged in that process.
You know, we had a guest on last week, the daughter of Consul General Dayan in New York, Ophir Dayan, who's a student at Columbia University, and she said it was less challenging serving in the Israel Defense Forces, serving the Israeli Army, than being on the campus here in America, because she's been verbally abused. She's been attacked, when she in any way expresses her Zionist views. So, you have it on the right, you have it on the left.
That's right, exactly. You have the BDS movement
on
campuses, boycotting, disinvestment, and sanctions. That is, it's spotty. It's not on every campus, but on some campuses in the U.S., it's very is very strong. And, you know, you can say certainly it's perfectly fine to be against the policy of a country that you're not happy with, but that morphs into anti-Semitism. And we see that in Europe as well. Although ostensibly it's directed at Israel, in fact, on the ground it translates into anti-Semitism, anti-Jewishness, and that's where the problem arises.
So we don't have any miraculous answers, but one of the things I've learned in my lifetime is that by camouflaging who you are, you're not going to win the day either. People aren't going to like you anymore, respect you anymore when you try to in some way hide your Jewishness, hide your identity. So we have to continue to be strong, continue to take safety measures, as you indicate, and to protect ourselves. But it's just shameful that we're still talking about this.
And one of the problems is you need the help of government to do this. And France has been committed to a secular approach to the world since the French Revolution. Basically, they don't acknowledge religion. So it sort of lessens their desire and even their ability to support religions that are being harassed, that are members are being assaulted, that sort of thing. Their response is not what it would be in this country. And a lot of it has to do with just simply the way they're structured. They just are not going to give too much attention to any particular religion because they'll be accused of favoritism, and that's simply that's not in their DNA there. So it's part of the problem. The government has to play a role. Believe it or not, in Germany, the government is pretty well engaged. In France, they certainly could be much more so. But we'll see if that happens at all.
I find it interesting that some of the people who protest policies in Israel, as you say, it's perfectly acceptable, are not the same people protesting policies in Iran or, you know, other countries that where they repress human rights.
Yeah.
Like what's allowed to others is not allowed to Israel, and that's when it, as you say, it morphs into anti-Semitism. When there's a different standard for one people than for all others, that's anti-Semitism.
Yes. and you know it can lead to big demonstrations in Europe. We haven't really seen that in this country, and those demonstrations always have the potential for violence. Now, anti-Semitic talk, anti-Semitic speech is against the law in France, but it's very seldom enforced. And the judges, who are in a different class of from society than we have here in this country, they just don't want to get engaged in the issue. So you still have some really vicious speech. Much of it comes across the internet. Much of the anti-Semitic movement is spurred by the internet, and difficult to enforce, difficult to identify exactly where it's coming from. But even so, it is still a crime in France, and not too much is being done about it.
So now you're no longer police commissioner of New York. You miss it?
Sure, you always miss the people. It was a great job, the best job I've had. No question about it, but life goes on.
I know when someone steps aside as being a rabbi, so when he listens to the other rabbi speaking, he says, gee, if I were saying it, it would be so much better. You know, if I were there, it would be much improved. But, you know, there comes a time when you have to step back, and you served honorably for so many years. We are privileged to have you as a police commissioner, and I want to say, as a member of the Jewish people, we're privileged to have you now embarking on this new initiative, because we know when you're tackling a problem, you're serious, you're sincere, and, you know, you don't just believe in doing something superficially.
So, no, thank you, Rabbi.
And
very nice.
I look forward to seeing you and your family. You're a great human being. And
just terrific. Thank you so much. You're pretty good yourself, sir. I'll see you soon, I know.
You're the standard, so I never quite get up to it, but you're the standard. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Former Commissioner Raymond Kelly, now CEO of the Guardian Group. This portion is brought to you by Calvary Hospital.
Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of religion on the line on 77 WABC.
77 WABC.
Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of religion on the line on 77 WABC.
Before we conclude the program today, I want to mention two issues that I think are very important. Firstly, I'm listening to the reports about Hurricane Michael and people refusing to leave and police asking them, give us the names of your next of kin. In case you don't make it, we have to notify them. And then someone said something I think is so, so important. That is, he says, I don't care what party the governor or the mayor is in Florida. It doesn't matter whether you like the person or don't like the person. We all have to work together to save life. And I know we live in this divide society. You're either on this side or that side, but there comes a time where we all have to be on the same side. When it comes to this hurricane, I know Americans who are so compassionate will all contribute to the cause of helping people rebuild their lives. I've seen numbers of fatalities. It's going to increase, but we're not going to solve the problem by seeing this as a Democratic or Republican issue. There's a human issue here that needs to be addressed. The second thing I want to mention is we all get asked to be in certain demonstrations, to volunteer for certain causes. And one of the questions I will ask is, tell me who the leaders are. I know the cause. I know the issue. Tell me who the leaders are. And it is very troubling to me when I see important causes, the Women's March, led by hate mongers. When I see Alinda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, when I see people who speak evil about the Jewish people, who say horrendous things about us, who embrace Louis Farrakhan, I can't stand in such company. So I would hope that people have to separate and say, look, I'll participate, but I'm not going to stand with these people. I'm not going to join if they're leading the demonstration. It's important. We tell our kids, you know, be careful of the company you keep because you judge people by the friends and friends can take you in the wrong direction. I don't see any reason why we can't do better and get leaders who are appropriate, who are decent, who are non-prejudicial, who are not anti-Semitic, who are not hateful. Shouldn't be so hard to find such people. They're out there.
77 WABC.